Hello everyone, good evening. Welcome at the Schönkunsthalle in our new building, Dondo Factory. I'm Martina Weinhardt and I had the pleasure to open the first exhibition here in this building with Stephanie Komilang's work. And I'm very happy that Stephanie had the time or took the time, she's incredibly busy, to come back for this evening, for this talk about her work, basically. But before we talk about your work, everyone probably knows you, but for those who don't know you that well, a short introduction. Stephanie Komilang is a Filipino-Canadian filmmaker, video artist, and installation artist. Stephanie Komilang's parents emigrated to Canada from the Philippines due to the Marcos regime, and Stephanie grew up in Toronto, right?
In Toronto.
And I guess this background shaped your idea about home and is very much deeply rooted in your work. You graduated from OCAD University in 2006. And since then had enormous, you really took off with a lot of great exhibitions. And we were in the very happy position that just recently, I mean, recently means 2024 and 25 even, had a huge production of two kind of very big and complex productions, Search for Life 1 and 2. Search for Life 1 was produced for TBA in Madrid, mm-hmm. and the second part of this diptych for the Sharjah Biennial. And you choose a third work as a prologue, which is Diaspora ad Astra, not that long as the other works. I mean, the two works are about 25 minutes and the third one has 5 minutes mm-hmm. length. So I think what we do is kind of walk through this exhibition. Maybe we start with Search for Life 1. Can you kind of walk us a little bit through this first of your major opus?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for having me back. Thank you for hosting the work. Thank you so much for coming, everyone. I hope you've all seen the exhibition. And if not, then you should go sometime.
I highly recommend.
I've done shows in Germany, but this is the biggest solo show. So it's three works, Search for Life 1, Search for Life 2, and a short video called Diaspora ad Astra. Maybe I'll start with Diaspora ad Astra because it was the first in the trilogy. So I call it a prequel, and it's the first one that I made. And I made it on commission for TBA21's website, commissioned by curator Chus Martinez, who asked me to make this work during Corona. So this was like at the beginning of 2020 when you couldn't travel, like things were closed and everything shut. So I don't know what you guys were reading on the news, but like, I mean, apart from like how scary things were, it stopped everything, right? So I was looking at stories of like ships that couldn't return to their ports. And like, I don't know if you remember, but like things couldn't be delivered. Like it was kind of like this major stoppage. Like you couldn't really, people, yeah. So that was one of the things that I was paying attention to. And 25% of the labor force that work on ships are from the Philippines. So this is something that I was thinking about as well. And a lot of the ships were in their home ports, but they couldn't return home. So that started something, it triggered maybe like an emotional thing in me because I was like, what does it mean to see your home in front of you but not be able to return to it? So I was thinking about, and the website for TBA 21, they do something called Ocean Archive. And it's about ocean intelligence. And this is something that I wasn't necessarily thinking about in my practice, really. The things that I think about have to do with home and migration and what home means and how amorphous that idea is. So because I was looking at the news and because I wanted, they had asked me to think about ocean intelligence, I made this film, short film, from the perspective of a Filipino seafarer called Diaspora Ad Astra, which is taken from a book that I had read, which is a collection of short stories of a book that I found of the same name that I found in the Philippines, which is like kind of adult, young adult fiction from the Philippines. And one of the stories was kind of similar, parallel to the story that I made of like the ship not being able to return, the spaceship not being able to return home because people on their home planet were scared of contracting a virus. So I used old footage that I had taken in the Philippines before because I couldn't travel.
Yeah, that would have been my question. How were you able to produce during that time?
It was all like it was all footage that I had taken from my phone and from my drone and just. And then I asked my dad to voice the seafarer. And yeah, so that's sort of how that started. And then after that video, I knew that I wanted to expand on this idea or thinking about seafarers because this job entails a lot of very, very hard labor and being away from home. So their contracts are 8 to 10 months of the year. So if you can imagine that, they have to stay on the ship. A lot of them can't even, when they go into cities or when they go into ports, they can't necessarily leave the port or go beyond certain borders because they don't have visas to do that. So while maybe they can get off the ships, they have to stay in like these contained spaces. There's no internet on the ships, so that's really hard, which means that they can't reach their families. So that is like really crazy to me. At least with other migrant laborers on land, they can speak to their families through the internet easily, but in this case they can't. They're working in very tough conditions. Payment is not regulated. They have to deal with climate, so, and smell. A lot of them work. Joar, one of the characters in the film, the painter, talks about.
Just for orientation, now we are in the second movie.
We're in
We left Diaspora Ad Astra and went to Search for Life 1. So
we're in Search for Life 1 now.
Yeah.
So this is sorry, I should clarify. Search for Life 1 came afterwards, and so I was able to expand on that film for a show in Madrid at the TBA 21 space in Madrid. This was in 2024. And so I was able to expand on this idea of the seafarer. I wanted to focus on seafarers. And I was able to meet and talk to and have two seafarers who had transformed into, had gone into other professions. So one, Joar, had gone into painting. He's such an amazing painter. Another had become a florist. Beautiful too. And
how did you find those guys?
Yeah.
I mean, you have such amazing characters in all your films. Mm. And first question probably, how do you start a project like that? I mean, your films are immensely complex, Search for Life 1 and 2. Mm. And they have so many different levels, so many different narratives. And
I I really take advantage of social media. I really find that that's like a really good tool to meet people and to get direct access to people. They can also check you out too. So it's a kind of reciprocal thing, you know? And also it's easy because I can like, for Search for Life 2, that project premiered in the United Arab Emirates, so in the UAE, where 90% of the population are migrants. And before oil, which was very recent, like 50 years ago, there was pearl diving. That was like the what was there for years and years and years before. So it's a history of pearls and pearl divings, and now it's oil and migrants. So I focused on that. And when I was doing research, I was looking at, because Filipinos are, when they go abroad and find work, they often take work in the entertainment industry because we're really good singers. So it's like a natural, easy job for them to take. So in the UAE, a lot of them were working in like restaurants and bands, singing for tourists. And so I was like kind of like looking on TikTok and Instagram. I was maybe going to work with like a band or thinking that I would work with a band. But then I found Pats, who you see, who is in this K-pop cover dance group. She's half Emirati, half Filipina. And I found her on TikTok because she was talking to someone. She was doing an interview with someone and she had mentioned all of these things and that she was half Filipina, half Emirati. So I was already obsessed with that because it's so stratified in the UAE. Like, the people don't necessarily mix, or it's like kind of maybe 10 years ago was a taboo to like mix, or so, especially Emiratis mixing with others. So I wanted to talk to her and meet her. And of course, because K-pop is not from there, it's also something that's come from a different place. And also the people who are in the K-pop, the Pixies they're called, they represent like the whole sort of spectrum of migrants of the UAE. So it was something that I wanted to look at there. So yeah, so I tend to find people. And I also like the how personal TikTok and Instagram can be, this sort of like vlog nature of things. You speak directly to someone. That's something that I really like, this sort of intimacy. So that's something that is really important to capture in the things that I make, or something that I want to convey. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this film connects in a way through the object of the pearl, different contexts, in that case, the Philippines and the UAE. But maybe we go, I mean, it's probably confusing, but shall we go back to the Search for Life 1,
sure.
Where you connect Mexico, mm-hmm. and the Philippines, who are, maybe not everyone's aware of that, both Spanish colonies and have a lot of kind of connections that we are not aware of.
Sure.
Maybe we can talk about that.
Yeah, I think like for me, I really like focusing on one thing and then kind of mapping things out from there. Because I think you can pick something, anything, and that one thing will be able to create a map on its own. So the monarch butterfly, seafarers. I was also looking at, in Search for Life 1, exactly the connections between Manila and Acapulco during the colonial period. So everything that was traded between these two places.
Yeah, but maybe we have to lay out the land a little bit. I don't know whether everyone has the film so present. So Search for Life 1 is getting into maritime life, about the two seafarers mainly. You were already describing the artist and the florist, yeah, and kind of enhances the field through a third protagonist and even a fourth, who are butterfly specialists, and in comes the monarch butterfly, and the connection between the different countries. Maybe you can tell that better than I do.
I think what's also important to mention is that I always think about context, like where I'm showing this work. So this work initially showed in Madrid, so I wanted to look at something that connected Spain and the Philippines. So I was looking at the archives when I was doing research in Madrid, and I went to the textile museum and was looking at the mantones, so the shawls, mantones de Manila, so the shawls of Manila. And you've seen them, I'm sure. They're triangular, very beautiful shawls that Spanish women, you know, they're traditional Spanish shawls that women have worn traditionally with embroideries, very colorful embroideries, fringe. And just in the name, you hear that it's from a different place. So I realized that they come from Manila, obviously, but why and how? And in pre-colonial times, the shawl was there. It was called a different thing. It was called the alambay, and it was used to protect from the sun and the rain, and it was just a regular cloth. But when the Spanish came, they made the women cover up. So it was a thing to cover themselves up. But further into colonial times, the mestizas, or the upper class, wanted to differentiate themselves from the lower class. So they had embroiderers, Chinese embroiderers who had been there for a long time, who are master embroiderers, create embroider scenes on these shawls. And then they became this luxury item, which then was exported first to Mexico, which was New Spain during that time, and then traveled to Spain and became the Mantón de Manila. So thinking of like context, where the work was shown in Madrid, I wanted to connect with a local audience. So that's why you see the veils in the exhibition, which are variations on a theme of the Mantón, but also a character in the film. So they become something that Joar the painter talks about and paints himself. You hear the Filipino the Spanish historian speak about the shawls embroidered. That's made out of pineapple fibers, I should mention, which are like the tops of pineapple leaves, which have been woven together. It's a very common fabric in the Philippines called piña fabric. But of course, the pineapple it's not from the Philippines, it's from South America. So another thing that's traveled. And it's embroidered with monarch butterflies, which are a character in the film as well.
We have to talk about the monarch, such an amazing creature.
Yeah, the monarch butterfly. When I was making this work, Search for Life One, my husband had a dream that I had an exhibition. I hadn't made the film yet, but he had a dream that I was having an exhibition, and the exhibition were paintings painted by butterflies. I don't paint, but he mentioned butterflies, and then it kind of like a light bulb went off, and I started doing research on monarch butterflies and realized that they are the longest traveling animals in the world. They go 8,000 kilometers over six generations. The fourth generation becomes what they call a super butterfly, so they grow twice as large and can travel twice the distance. But it's like, the great, 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 great granddaughter of the butterfly who leaves. It's this crazy thing that they know where to go. And even before that, they're a caterpillar, and then they turn into a butterfly. And in their cocoon stage, they liquefy, and the only thing that like survives from caterpillar is the nervous system. So they remember as butterflies being caterpillars. I don't know. There's all of these crazy things that I learned from the butterfly specialist, and then just doing research and going to Michoacán in Mexico.
And I mean, it's hard to even imagine that this small animal is flying from Mexico all the way to Canada.
It's incredible. How? it's amazing.
I always thought you put it in as a kind of symbol for resilience.
The butterfly occupies such a space in like human psyche for transformation, and transformation can mean so many things for so many different people, like Mariah, or like, I don't know, like, you know, if you're going through like something in your life, and the butterfly is like really this like symbol of like hope and change and all of those things. But there's just so many things that I learned about the butterfly that were like this nice thing to think about while I was like writing dialogue, because the film is kind of from the perspective of the butterfly, sort of. So I thought about all of those things while I was writing.
What I really also like about this kind of image of the butterfly is that it also kind of travels from the realm of the film into the realm of the exhibition, which brings us to your kind of dealing with the presentation of your films in general. I mean, I'm sure for almost everyone, it's really a very immersive experience. I mean, not only in Search for Life 1, also in Search for Life 2, where you have the pearls in the film and also in the exhibition space. Yeah. And in Search for Life, probably even more, because you have this opposite lying or ordered projections, and you're absolutely in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's... I started out as a filmmaker, only film. So I wasn't really thinking about like a larger architecture or space for people, because I was never really asked to, but I started working more with space when I was asked to for this performance and video triennial called Ghost, which happened in Bangkok. And I had made a film called Come to Me Paradise about Filipina domestic workers in Hong Kong. And that film has a lot to do with architecture and how the women create space for themselves, because by law, they have to live with their employers. I don't know if you've been to Hong Kong, but Hong Kong is a place where like everything is about space, because everything is so condensed. So if you think about the people that don't matter or something, where do they go? So what they do on their days off, because they have to live with their employers, is that they spill out onto the street and occupy or squat or something the spaces, the financial district and other spaces in Hong Kong, and then kind of create their own architectures, their own private architectures made of cardboard and string, which are basically like makeshift rooms. So what I created for the exhibition for a more architectural exhibition was a three-channel installation that mimicked the spaces that the women make. And so that was the first time that I thought about expansion for the audience, not just for the screen, but for a space for the audience to inhabit. And then that really just opened up so many possibilities to think about how like the audience can experience something. So now I'm thinking a lot about like screens, and yeah, like how you can see things from different perspectives. So you can go behind the pearl curtain and look at it from that way. You can, depending on where you're sitting in Search for Life 2 with a mirror, you can see different perspectives. In its initial showing at Sharjah in Search for Life 2 with the pearl curtains, it was shown very differently. Like I had a big pearl screen, yes, but I also had a wooden pier that you could like climb up onto and like walk out into the sea and walk below. And I had an LED screen behind it. So there was many different perspectives. And that's what I think about both in my filmmaking and now in an expanded installation setting.
Yeah, I mean, great that you mentioned Search for Life 2. I would like to stay there for a little bit longer. The film starts, I mean, it tells the story of the pearl more or less in different layers, and also kind of how the notion of wealth changed from pearl to oil to money and all of that. But what I found interesting to learn is about the beginning of the film starts with the peoples of the Samabajau. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about them.
So in the most, the closest part to Malaysia in the Philippines is a place called Tawi Tawi. And historically, it's been Muslim. And it's quite different from the rest of the Philippines, which is very Christian, Catholic. And the Samabajau inhabit this space. And for a very long time, they were boat people, they call themselves. So they're an indigenous group that were living on water. So you could see how they live in the film. They live on stilts, so stilt architecture. They're boat people. A lot for a long time they've lived on boats, and now they're sort of creeping more towards land. But they're stateless, which means that they don't have access to things like healthcare, education, a passport. And now there are borders, which means that legally they can't really pass, but they do. Malaysia is closer to them than the rest of the Philippines. So, and also they, because they lived on the sea, they farm the sea. So anything that you could get from the sea. So of course, food, pearls, they would trade pearls. They would trade pearls for gold. Gold was something that and is now still a commodity. So I was interested in this area of the Philippines because it related to the context of the UAE with the pearl. And actually, traders from the UAE would trade with the Samabajau, with the people from Tawi Tawi. So there was this connection there that I wanted to look at.
What I found, I mean, what touched me most was to see kind of the incredible skills that these divers of the Samabajau had. And I think even one of them is telling in the film that even the elders were able to stay underwater for 10 minutes. And then you have kind of this contrast to different way of farming the sea. Which is kind of, you have this poetic image of these divers under the sea, and then you have this kind of messy farming, ugly, muddy.
Exactly. So with the Samabajau, I'm sort of bringing it more into like an older time frame, because they talk about how their elders would farm and be able to stay underwater for 10 minutes. Yeah, it's kind of amazing if you think about it. They're losing it now because the pearl isn't, and this is the connection to China, it's not really worth that much anymore because of farming. So farming came in to play, I think, in the 40s or 50s with the Japanese, I forget his name, but there are farms now, and the biggest farm production, freshwater pearl production, is in China. So that's why the film goes there, because I wanted to look at it from a contemporary perspective. And so I visited pearl farms 2 hours outside of Shanghai, where they have both, in the place that I went, pearl farming and production of socks. I like got off the train and it was like socks and then pearls. But like China's like that, right? Like each city is like manufacturing something very specific. But what was interesting, so in the exhibition in Sharjah, which you unfortunately you don't get to see here, there's another screen which touches on more of like the technological aspects that I was looking at. So I was really obsessed with like live streams of, because in China, live streaming is so much more ubiquitous than it is here. That's how they connect, but also do a lot of business. So they have a lot of live streamers on TikTok who are opening pearls and selling them directly to the consumer. So when I was in China, going to the pearl farms, we were driving, and it was just farmland, really. It was farmland, the pearl farms. But all of a sudden, I saw these glass boxes on the side of the road, and I asked my fixer, what is that? And she was like, oh, those are for the live streamers. I was like, why? For the farmers, so they could live stream what they're doing and for business, but also for the people who are selling pearls, but also tourists and stuff like that. So I kind of became obsessed with these people who were opening the pearls. And then also, sometimes I would get weird things of like these like Asian women going beside a river and opening up these huge clams, and out would come like thousands of pearl, like colored pearls, which are fake, but were kind of like, they were directly inspired by these Chinese live streamers. So the screen in Sharjah had those videos, live streamers, also this nail person that you see, the nails, which kind of fold into like the more the contemporary aspect of pearls.
That's interesting currency. That you kind of create this stream of consciousness. I mean, all these different layers in your narratives edited together, and you mirror it through kind of mixing the techniques and the different sources, no?
Yeah. I'm interested in like, yeah, exactly, like kind of mixing times and spaces and places. And again, because I call my films science fiction documentaries, and I feel like documentary is a very difficult genre to do on its own, because I feel like the person who makes it frames the film as like a truth or like the truth, and I don't think that's fair or... Yeah, so that's why I have these perspectives both in the installation but also with cameras that I use. I filmed with like a Meta glasses, a drone, a regular camera, my phone. Like there was many, many different cameras, and I always use different cameras. Maybe you don't see it, it's not so apparent, but I like thinking about things in this way. I like mixing genres. I like stacking timelines and perspectives and stories and narratives all on top of each other, because I feel it creates a rounder picture.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to hand over the discussion into our audience. Maybe there are questions so far.
Or you can just talk to me afterwards.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Stephanie.